Welcome to the McLean's Politics Show. I'm Cormac McSweeney.
And I'm Aaron Wherry.
Today, an iconic Canadian musician mixes it up with politicians and big oil. Neil Young is touring the country to speak out against the oil sands, and we'll be joined by Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver for his take on this war of words.
Meanwhile, much to Neil Young's chagrin, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird heads south of the border to put pressure on the U.S. government to make a decision on the Keystone XL pipeline.
And we'll be joined by McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes to talk NDP strategy and the Conservatives' last-ditch effort to save the Canada Job Grant. For your political news and analysis, and I guess even your rock and roll, welcome to the McLean's Politics Show. This week, Canadian rock icon Neil Young began a battle with the federal government by launching an anti-oil sands fundraising tour. He had a lot to say in his first news conference. Here's a quick montage of his comments.
It's the greediest, most destructive, and disrespectful demonstration. So I described it as Hiroshima, which was basically pretty mellow compared to what was really going on up there. Our future depends on science. Science is the roadmap. Science cannot be ignored as inconvenient. We are killing these people. The blood of these people will be on modern Canada's hands.
Young attacks the government's environmental record, targets big oil, and criticizes the way First Nations treaties have not been respected. The industry has fired back, calling Young ill-informed, and it's even invited him to a meeting in Calgary. The Prime Minister's office is not impressed either. Stephen Harper's Director of Communications, Jason McDonald, released a statement saying oil sands development is fundamental to Canada's economy, and even rock stars utilize the products that come from this resource.
With more on the government's response, Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver has taken some time out of his trip to India to speak with me. Minister, thank you for coming on here today. Neil Young has had some harsh words for the energy companies operating in northern Alberta and the environmental record of the federal government. How do you respond to this?
Well, I respond with the facts. We base our decisions in respect to the development of our resources on independent, scientifically grounded regulatory reviews. And we frankly don't take into account the opinion of an entertainer, no matter how talented, who compares Fort McMurray to Hiroshima. It's as insulting as it is inaccurate. The natural resources of Canada are an enormous advantage to our country. They create 1.8 million jobs on an annual basis. They represent more than half of our exports. $30 billion every year goes into government revenue to support critical social programs like healthcare and housing. We're talking about almost a fifth of the Canadian economy and an opportunity for prosperity and security for Canadians for generations to come, including our Aboriginal peoples. So, for Neil Young to denigrate a job-creating sector, which is so important, the biggest employer of Aboriginal peoples, is not really responsible. And for him to do it in an exaggerated way and to use his own fame to advance a cause that at the end of the day will hurt the very people he claims he wants to protect.
But isn't it fair to say there's at least some room for criticism? Last week we heard Canada will miss out on its own greenhouse gas emissions targets, and in October we found out in-situ mines will not be subject to federal environmental assessment. So is it the criticism alone that you object to, or just the extent to which Young's criticism has gone?
No, it's the inaccuracy of the criticism. I mean, you suggest that that in situ is not being reviewed federally. It has never been, but that doesn't mean it won't be reviewed. It's reviewed provincially, and we have eliminated as much duplication in review as we can. But that doesn't mean we've eliminated regulatory review. Quite to the contrary, we have focused our energy on the larger projects that can have an environmental impact. We will not go ahead as a government with any project that is not safe for Canadians and safe for the environment.
But when we're missing out on our own greenhouse gas targets, does that not warrant stricter regulations?
Well, we are determined to meet our greenhouse gas emission targets. We're working on we've invested over $10 billion in alternative energy, reducing the environmental footprint of conventional and non-conventional energy, and we're going to continue to do that. I mean, the oil sands, for example, have seen a decrease in GHG emissions on a per-barrel basis by 26% over the last decade or so. The oil sands represent only 1/1,000th of global emissions, so it's a minuscule part of the problem. But as responsible global citizens, we've got to do even better, and we're going to continue to do that. Look, we have lower emissions per capita than the Americans do, lower emissions in relation to our economy than the Americans do. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do more, and we're going to continue to do more.
Now, Minister, Neil Young is famous worldwide, and he's not the first celebrity to speak out against the oil sands. Does Canada need to do more to demonstrate to the world that it's responsible with its resources?
Look, there are some people who are opposed to the development of hydrocarbons. And, so some people you simply can't reach. What we want to do is communicate with Canadians and with people in other countries who are open to facts, who are open to what the scientists say, who are taking a reasonable and balanced approach to these important but sometimes very complex issues.
So then, is that the point of the $22 million international advertising blitz that the government is undertaking?
Yeah, well, I think it is important to get the facts out, to make people aware of two things. One, what we're doing to protect the environment, and two, what the enormous economic and social benefits of developing our resources responsibly is. People aren't necessarily expert in these areas, and so it's important for us to get the facts out, to do it in an objective way, to be scrupulously honest and when we do it. We have to counter some of the exaggeration and the distortion.
And the last question I have for you, Minister, is a simple one. Are you a fan of Neil Young's music?
I like Neil Young's music, sure. But that's really not the point, is it? I can listen to his music and not admire his politics.
Fair enough, Minister. Thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.
Of course, Neil Young isn't the first celebrity to face off with the government. With his take on this battle, here's Maclean's Adrian Lee.
There's a sentiment that floats around whenever we think about culture, and if it's not quite an adage, it's certainly a natural bias we should all probably admit to. And that sentiment is this. We believe that artists should just stick to their one thing. First, let's set aside the fact that Neil Young is indisputably one of our finest musical exports. And actually, while we're at it, let's also set aside the reality that Young hasn't really put out more than one essential album in the last decade. Instead, let's figure out why we're so uncomfortable with Young talking political shop. And the answer? It's right there. We think Neil Young should stick to singing tracks off of Harvest and leave the politics to the wonks and the watchers. But if we're uncomfortable about this, we really shouldn't be. Let me digress for a minute. For decades, philosophers of science have more or less agreed that objectivity in science never really existed. Instead, philosophers like Bruno Latour say that what we agree is factually correct is driven by a majority consensus of scientists who are actually rife with beliefs and biases that they apply to their findings. The more scientists believe something, the more we see that as being objectively true. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean science is false. Scientists do have the benefit of rigorous research to swat away any climate change deniers in the audience. But science can boil down to the equivalent of 4 out of 5 dentists agree this brand of toothpaste is the best. That toothpaste is probably the best one, though, and I for one would buy it. Hard to say you wouldn't either. All right, so what does one old French philosopher have to do with Neil Young and politics? Well, the reality of celebrity culture is that their platform dramatically increases their value in these weighted consensus affairs. They're not scientists, no, but they get to speak much louder than them. They're able to tip the scales and build a consensus all their own. So it's a heavy crown to wear, and some wear it really badly. In the US, you've got people like Jenny McCarthy saying vaccinations cause autism, which science generally agrees is kind of preposterous. And here in Canada, there's Pamela Anderson, slow motion bounding into Newfoundland to stop the seal hunt by offering career hunters a pithy sum of money. In that instance, it looked like the emperor, or rather the lifeguard, wears no clothes. Now, Young isn't new by any stretch to the political block. Ohio is probably the platonic ideal of a folk protest tune. Plus, he's been advocating for the environment since as early as 1985, so it seems clear he's done his own research. But the solution isn't for us to box people into their one thing. Maybe the solution is to trust ourselves to parse the Andersons from the Youngs, the harvest wheat from the chaff, and decide on our own what we think. After all, like Bruno Latour says, facts are only facts until we find out they're wrong. Now, Young isn't perfect. His comparison of the oil sands to Hiroshima might have been a bit over the top. The hybrid electric car he boasts about feeds on ethanol, and there are plenty of reports that suggest it needs too much farmland, and that making ethanol actually takes more energy than the energy produced by ethanol. But if there's one truth, it's this. Neil Young moved the needle before he saw the damage done. And if he knows what he's talking about, there's really no reason to take issue with him not doing what's easy. And that's sticking to his own thing.
While a Canadian rock icon heads back north of the border to bash big oil, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird has gone south to push for a pipeline. Coming up, we're joined by our colleague Paul Wells to talk about Keystone XL.
After Neil Young created a stir in Canada, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird made a trip to the United States to push the Obama administration to make up its mind on the Keystone XL pipeline.
The time for a decision on Keystone is now. Even if it's not the right one, we can't continue in this state of limbo.
I sat down with my colleague Paul Wells to ask him about what's behind this meeting and where it may lead for the Harper government.
First of all, I guess John Baird went down to Washington and made some rather dramatic demands of the United States vis-a-vis Keystone and wanting an answer now. I guess, first of all, what do we make of this?
So, yeah, the foreign minister on Thursday went down to Washington to deliver a lunchtime speech where he said he wants the American federal government, the Obama administration, to make a decision on the Keystone pipeline authorization. I don't recall a Canadian official going to another country to essentially request a decision on a policy file ever. And it expresses mounting frustration in the Harper government at Barack Obama personally, because he's the person who's going to approve or reject the Keystone pipeline. And he was supposed to deliver a decision on that before the 2011 election, or before the 2012 election. He punted that decision until after the election. And it's now more than a year since he was reelected. He still hasn't done anything. And there is growing evidence that the president wants to delay a decision still further, perhaps until the midterms next year, or in the autumn of this year. So the Harper government has decided that they want a decision, and they don't care particularly whether it's a yes or a no. They just want to stop having to wonder about this. Incidentally, by asking for a decision from the White House now, Harper has essentially made it clear that he will not be doing anything to sweeten the pot for the Americans. For instance, bringing in new emissions regulations for the oil and gas sector, he's not going to be doing that. He says, what's on offer is as good as it's going to get. Now tell us whether it's going to be good enough.
If Keystone's rejected, doesn't this become a domestic problem for the Harper government in terms of, if you don't have oil and gas regulations, that's a pretty easy thing to blame for a result on Keystone. At what point is the Harper government making itself vulnerable on this file?
I think they've essentially decided this can't go any worse for them. and that at least once they have a firm no from the Americans, the Harper government can react accordingly by accelerating a decision, a fully domestic decision on the Gateway pipeline, which would go to British Columbia from the oil sands. They can announce that they will not be bringing in oil and gas regulations. The Americans haven't. And the Canadian position so far has been, we'll be happy to do it as soon as the Americans do, essentially making Obama again to blame for the delay in domestic oil and gas regulations. But meanwhile, this weird shadow boxing where they have to talk about other files with Obama. We are told that every time the Prime Minister calls the President, he discusses Keystone. At some point, that's got to be a little wearing. They've got other things that he would like to discuss, or he would like to go straight to the mode of not calling Obama at all because he's angry at him. But he can't be angry until Obama announces a decision.
So where does this go from here? We've had a bit of a response already from the White House, stamping your feet and demanding an answer, and then getting told, "Well, you're not going to get an answer right now." It just puts us sort of back where we were yesterday. Where does this go? I guess twofold. Where does this go first for the government internationally with the United States and the president, and two, domestically? Amidst all this, we have Neil Young making all sorts of noise. We have Northern Gateway looking for approval or rejection. We have environmental regulations that have yet to be announced. We have Copenhagen targets to meet. This is quite a kettle of fish. Where does the Harper government take it from here?
Well, eventually they take it to an election where the government will campaign as the only friend of the resource-producing sector. The Liberals blow hot and cold on the file. The New Democrats are, by and large, opposed to any specific pipeline project, although they tend to like... They claim to like pipeline projects in general. They don't like any of the specific projects. What strikes me is that we're back to the... cross-border curse that afflicts prime ministers and presidents who belong to different party currents. Lawrence Martin, the columnist and author, wrote a book almost 30 years ago about presidents and prime ministers, and he pointed out that when you've got a liberal prime minister and a conservative president, or vice versa, there's trouble. Diefenbaker and Kennedy, Reagan and Trudeau, Bush and Chrétien, after Lawrence wrote his book. And now, despite the best efforts of Obama and Harper, who had high hopes for their relationship when they started up, this Democratic president and this conservative prime minister are basically not getting along at all. What's striking in their particular case is that they're very similar guys. They're not from different generations. They're both baby boomer heads of government. Neither showed a history of particular curiosity about the world before they became heads of government. Neither had traveled much before they became party leaders. Neither is a sort of a chatty, warm fellow who needs buddies. We don't hear a lot of stories about Obama spending time on the phone to anyone. And we don't hear a lot of stories about Harper's international head of government friends besides Obama. It's not as though there was someone else that he's calling instead. They're insular guys, and it's taken some time. But I think we're starting to see the effect of that, which is that they don't see eye to eye on nearly anything now.
Lastly, let's make a prediction. Is Keystone going to get approved?
I'll be astonished if Keystone is approved. It began about a year ago when Obama, in speeches, started to mention Keystone only in the context of what his opponents, the Republicans, were asking for. He has, for more than a year now, he has essentially not talked about Keystone as a potentially beneficial source of oil and energy independence for a North American market. I should emphasize, is the way many Democrats talk about Keystone. It's not only Republicans. But Obama decided a long time ago that Keystone was just one of the many things Republicans would send his way to bedevil him. And he gives every impression of not wanting any part of it.
How you have written the book on Mr. Harper now, if Keystone gets rejected, what does that do for both his immediate concerns politically and his legacy?
Well, at the end of 2011, the Prime Minister suggested that if he didn't get Keystone, or even just the fact that Obama in re-election mode had punted a decision on Keystone, would lead the Prime Minister to encourage energy exports to the Asian market. What he has since learned is that that's harder, it's easier said than done. And what he'll have to demonstrate fairly soon, since he's the resource exporting guy, is that he can have any beneficial impact on resource exports to any market. If the Keystone door is definitively closed, then he's got to not only get Gateway built, he's got to demonstrate that there's a paying market for our resources besides the United States. This is becoming a bit of a repeat theme with this Prime Minister. He's starting to need a win.
Coming up, we're joined by Maclean's Bureau Chief John Geddes to discuss the NDP's future and how the Harper government is struggling with its job grant program. It's now time for the Maclean's panel, where we're joined by Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. We're going to start by taking a look at the two-day NDP strategy session at the end of this week. John, where are the New Democrats heading?
Well, it sounds like Mulcair is going to try to change the channel a little bit on the sorts of issues that he's associated with. I mean, if you think about it, Mulcair is now identified so closely with the Senate controversy and his kind of prosecutorial stance on that in the House of Commons that I think he probably imagines that's just a little bit too combative, a little bit too negative in some cases, although he's done well on that issue. It's not a great image builder for him. So one thing he's been talking about this week is trying to put his own brand on some consumer issues. He's talked about ATM fees as something people are upset about. He's talked about gas prices, prices at the pumps. These are both issues that, to me, sound suspiciously close to what the Tories have always thought that they have, which is a kind of a good brand around protecting consumers in the economy. And you recall that last year's throne speech was supposed to be about a sort of consumer agenda for the government. So what we see is Mulcair sort of edging into that territory.
And is he also trying to encroach on the middle class voter that Justin Trudeau seems to be aiming for?
Yeah, I think that's been a mantra for a couple of elections now for pretty much all the party leaders. The middle class voter, particularly the suburban middle class voter, is seen as the sort of core constituency that everybody wants to compete for. No secret why that is. I mean, if you look at where there are seats up for grabs, it's suburban Toronto and to a lesser degree, suburban Vancouver. So, yeah, this is a theme that they think could play with that constituency. This is Mulcair assuming that he's got a pretty good hold on some of his other base, urban, young people, Quebec voters who don't see another alternative, those sorts of people.
So, Aaron, where do you see the growth for the NDP, and what's their biggest challenge moving forward?
I think they've obviously got some advantages with Tom Mulcair and the reputation he's built up, the credibility he's built up over the past year. I think they've got a certain brand. You talk about these ATM fees, it's kind of a silly issue, but it's the sort of thing that speaks to a larger idea of what the party's about and what they're aiming to do and who they're out there fighting for. The main problem for them, I think, remains the Justin Trudeau question and whether or not that bubble is ever going to burst. I don't see how they get back to first place. I don't see how they win government unless the Liberals tumble again. And so you find yourself sort of hoping, if you're an NDPer, that Trudeau is somehow going to falter. And if he doesn't, then what happens? Are you forever doomed back to third place, or is there some path to power that remains here?
Let's switch gears a little bit to the Canada Job Grant. We saw this week the federal government pulling back a little bit. They had spent a lot of money after millions of dollars advertising for the program that hasn't yet been put in place. Now they're trying to concede to the provinces. John, what went on here?
It's a disaster right now for the federal government. They're not casting it as such, but it really is. It's a disaster for this reason. It was the big thing they announced, the big original innovative thing they announced in last year's budget. It was a surprise to the provinces. It speaks a little bit to the Harper government's tendency to not want to do a lot of consultation with the provinces. They really don't have a very systematic consultation habit ingrained yet. So they went out with something not realizing the provinces were going to fight back against it hard. And the reason the provinces fought so hard is predictable. It's a lot of money. They're losing a lot of money under this program that they used to get from Ottawa with very few strings attached for employment training kind of programs. And now they're being asked to contribute more while they're losing that kind of direct, easy funding.
Surprising in a way that Jason Kenney, who's seen as a fairly tough customer, was put in charge of this file and yet has been the guy who's kind of walked it back. The interesting question now is whether the provinces will accept this, the current stance, or whether they'll push even further. I suspect some provinces will want to push harder because what the federal position is now is, well, we're not going to demand that the provinces cough up their own money for it, but we're still going to insist that the federal money be spent in this in the way we want to, in this new sort of, it's a program where job training funds would be attached to particular jobs rather than put into large pools for training underutilized workers. So yeah, this is a tough one. Federal-provincial conflicts almost always boil down to who's going to get what money and will there be any strings attached. It's been the debate in healthcare. It's been the debate in all kinds of regional development transfers, and we're seeing that dynamic evolve again here.
And Aaron, I'll jump back a little bit to my first question where I mentioned the advertising. I mean, this is a program that the government really pushed hard and spent more than $2 million advertising to Canadians. How difficult is it for them to try and get this through after investing so much?
I think this goes back to a question that's been raised around this government ever since they announced their quote-unquote economic action plan, which is the amount of money they spend advertising their own policies and their own initiatives. Now you have money spent on an initiative that may not come to fruition or may not come to fruition in the exact same way you thought it was going to. Meanwhile, you're advertising, running these ads, challenging the wireless industry. You're essentially kind of taking on a private industry with government money. These questions all come back to what exactly are we spending all this money for? Is it just to sort of improve the government's electoral chances? This question has sort of been around for a while now. There's a private members bill from David McGuinty that would sort of turn the advertising model into sort of what they do in Ontario, which submits government advertising to the Auditor General for review. That sort of prevents governments from sort of using advertising for their own electoral benefits, at least in theory. I think that's now going to gain a lot of steam as an idea. I would imagine that everybody is going to be kind of jumping on this when the House comes back, the fact that this money is being spent and why, and the fact that it's public money being spent.
And that ends our panel and our show for this week.
Thank you to Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver and from the McLean staff, Paul Wells and Adrian Lee.
Tune in next week for the McLean's Politics Show.